There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind in the statement that I made in the sheriff's office immediately after the shooting, and the statement that I made to the Warren Commission, that I made it very plain there was no doubt in my mind what there was definitely a shot fired from behind that picket fence.
But most importantly, he alienated the CIA because he did stop the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba, and it is my belief that he was getting ready to pull out of our tiny, at that point, tiny presence in Vietnam. He had already withdrawn 1,000 troops, and he didn't think the war was winnable, and so he wasn't essentially an idealist, but a pragmatist. And pragmatic people are generally wiser than ideologues, like the right-wing lunatics who wanted the war in Vietnam. And so he had to be killed, just as his brother had to be killed.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. Look, you've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
But what really destroyed McCarthy was that camera that's looking at me now. It was 188 hours that the American people looked at him. And nobody can hide in 188 hours. In 188 hours, if you're a good guy, it's revealed, no matter how clever you are or how much you want to hide even being a good guy. And if you're a bad guy, it's also revealed. And McCarthy was revealed, and the machine stripped him, and he was destroyed.
Emile D'Antonio was America's foremost maker of documentary films, hard-hitting political documentaries. We interview him and play portions of his films right now on Alternative Views.
Emile D'Antonio, one of the greatest documentary filmmakers of all time, has taken on the tough and controversial issues of his day. His first film, Point of Order, took on Joe McCarthy, the demagogic senator who carried out the anti-communist witch hunts. His second film is on the Kennedy assassination. That film, Rush to Judgment, attacks the Warren Commission and the theory that a lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, killed JFK. D'Antonio then made a controversial film on the Vietnam War, In the Year of the Pig, which attacked U.S. aggression in Vietnam. His next film, Milhouse, presented a critical portrait of Richard Milhouse Nixon and got D'Antonio on Nixon's enemy list. Later in the 1970s, D'Antonio made a film about the Weather Underground, the 1960s radicals who were high on the FBI's most wanted list. Dee found them and made a film. The FBI couldn't. In addition, he finished his film on the New York art scene, Painter's Painting, and made a film, In the King of Prussia, on the Catholic pacifist who attacked a nuclear weapons installation in Pennsylvania. Most recently, D'Antonio has finished a semi-autobiographical documentary, Mr. Hoover and I, about his films, his politics, and his longtime relationship with the FBI, which compiled over 10,000 pages of documents on him and his filmmaking and other activities.
Today on Alternative Views, we're going to talk with Mr. D'Antonio about his politics, his films, And we'll learn about his views about Joe McCarthy, an extreme white right wing in the United States, about Richard Nixon, the Vietnam War, the JFK assassination, radical politics, communism, film and art, nuclear energy. That ought to keep us busy for a few days.
Well, we'll also discuss D'Antonio's contribution to the art of the documentary film and how he conceives the relationship between film and politics, and we'll show you some clips from his films as well as interviews with him. In fact, this is the first part of a multi-part series on D'Antonio's work on alternative views.
I'd like to ask you, why at the age of 40 did you start making films? And then the second question, why did you choose Joe McCarthy as your first topic?
Well, those are two entirely separate questions,
right.
So let me deal with question one first. I'd been basically uninterested in film because I saw film in my early life as essentially a commercial enterprise. Films were made to make money. Films were made to avoid the reality of life. Documentaries like Flaherty's Louisiana Story were fraudulent. They presented a false picture. And I saw no space for me in that world. And then the New York scene changed, and it changed film in a very precise anti-Hollywood way. And this began with a film that Jack Kerouac wrote called Pull My Daisy. It featured a great number of major artists like Robert Frank, the cinematographer, like Alfred Leslie, the painter, like a great actress, Delphine Seyrig, who went on to become a star in France, a great singer, Anita Ellis, and they were all in this film. It's very offbeat, made for very little money, and it's absolutely the quintessential expression of the Beat Generation. And I thought, if these people can make a film for almost nothing, and it's one of the best films made, maybe it's time for me to look at what should be done.
Did you have background in film at that time?
I think most successful people in the arts begin in innocence. I had no background, which means that I had no garbage to get rid of, no detritus to get rid of. I mean, all that stuff that's taught in film school is simply taught so that you junk it at some point. And there was nothing I wanted from Hollywood except to junk what that had been. So I went directly to a thing that had never been done before in this country, which is I was able to buy from ABC the complete Army McCarthy hearings, 188 hours. Now, this was one of the great and most important political moments in American life, because when McCarthy began those hearings, when the government began the hearings with McCarthy in April of 1954, McCarthy was high. He was riding high. He was the most prominent and powerful figure in American politics. He had changed the nature of American politics. He had said, "You're a communist." And even if you were, as indeed he did, even if you were a cleaning woman in the State Department, and you didn't even know what the word communism meant, you were a communist because McCarthy called you one. And the word communist was used blatantly, without consideration, without judiciousness, without sensibility, to condemn all kinds of people, most of whom were not communists.
I know that many of my good friends seem to feel this is sort of a game you can play. That you can talk about communism as though it's something 10,000 miles away. Mr. Jenkins, to answer to your question, let me say it's right here with us now. If we, unless we, make sure that there is no infiltration of our government, then just as certain as you sit there, in the period of our lives, you will see a red world. Mr. Jenkins, anyone who has followed the communist conspiracy, even remotely, and who can add two and two will tell you that there is no remote possibility of this war which we're in today, and it's a war which we've been losing, no remote possibility of this ending except by victory or by death for this civilization.
By the time the hearings were over, and for the first time you had a hearing in which a demagogue like McCarthy was exposed to all of the American people, the audiences for those hearings were huge, bigger than World Series games, really huge audiences. And by the time the hearings were over, McCarthy was finished. He was no longer a political entity. Now, I wanted to take all that raw material, and it's not a question of editing or of reducing. It's a question of making something, of creating a structure, of making a film that had never been made before. I named it Point of Order because those words were heard throughout America for months. Point of order, point of order. And all was disorder, of course. And that was the film.
Point of order? I don't know what it is, but it's a point of something. My point of order is that Mr. Jenkins yesterday was imposed upon, and so was the Secretary of the Army, by having a doctored or altered photograph produced in this courtroom as if it were honest.
This is a committee room, Mr. Wilson.
A committee room, and produced as if it were honest. I have the photograph that was offered yesterday in evidence, and in respect to which Mr. Stevens was not only examined but cross-examined. And I show you now a photograph in respect to which I charge that what was offered in evidence yesterday was an altered, shamefully cut down picture, so that somebody could say to Stevens, were you not photographed alone with David Shine, when the truth is he was photographed in a group. I would like now to offer the picture that I have in my right hand as the original, undoctored, unaltered piece of evidence.
Mr. Chairman, the point of order is this, that Mr. Welch, under the guise of making a point of order, has testified that a picture is doctored. I now have before me, and I may say this is yesterday was the first time I saw either of these pictures, the picture that was introduced yesterday, the one Mr. Welch puts in today. He makes a completely false statement, so this is a group picture. It is not.
The counsel advises the chair, may I say that...
May I finish my point of order, Mr. Chairman?
You're not a point of order, you can't touch it. The counsel advises the chair that the senator is engaging in a statement
Mr. Chairman,
a point of order.
Mr. Chairman, I'm getting rather sick of being interrupted in the middle of a sentence. Now, Mr. Chairman, do I have the floor now, or do I not? May I suggest, I'm getting awfully sick of sitting down here at the end of the table and having whoever wants to interrupt in the middle of a sentence. Now, Mr. Welch made a statement. I raised a point of order that it was not a proper point of order. But it was not a proper point of order that he raised. And when Mr. Welch, under the guise of a point of order, said this was a group picture, I suggest that the chair make the record clear that Mr. Welch was not speaking the truth. That's the only change in
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to interrupt the senator from Wisconsin. I agree with the senator from Wisconsin that Mr. Welch did not make a point of order. I further make the statement the senator from Wisconsin is not making a point of order. I think that should be made perfectly clear to both Mr. Welch and Senator McCarthy.
Can I ask you this now? CBS and Edward R. Murrow's expose on McCarthy, did that come before or after your documentary?
Before, And it was thin stuff.
Right.
And don't forget, Murrow was on TV every week.
And hadn't.
And he waited until that end point to do his short, indecisive piece on McCarthy. His was a basically journalistic response, whereas mine was an attempt to do something else, which was to make art out of political raw material, to make art, to make a political art, which had not happened in this country. It was tried in the theater. Orson Welles did one of the first ones. In the Great Depression, it was tried in the theater under WPA. Political art was made, but not film. And film was too dangerous because it reached too many people. So political films were not encouraged. Pseudo-political films were encouraged, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, all those early classics. But films that were really about what is politics, who runs the country, how do they run it, to what end, I don't think that really happened until Point of Order.
Dee, what distinguished Point of Order from other documentaries in terms of style?
Well, the one thing that bothered me more than anything else, particularly about sleazy network documentaries, is that they always depended on some idiotic narrator, Cronkite, somebody who knew nothing about the subject, who would simply read off a teleprompter. I wanted to destroy that voice. I wanted the people who themselves were in the film to be the only voices heard. So I began Point of Order with my voice over Black Leader, and I say for 59 seconds, everything you were about to see actually happened. And I go on in that vein for 50 seconds more, and then I'm out, and there's no other voice heard except those people who really were part of that historical moment.
Obviously, you wanted to show his downfall, so you had to pick some moments in the hearings that would, in effect, show or reveal McCarthy unraveling. What moments do you think are most striking?
Well, I think the most emotional moment, and the most dramatic moment, and the most dramatic and the most emotional are not necessarily the most political, but it's something that happened before the hearings began that then burst towards the end of the hearings. Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's assistant, had a problem. He beat the draft. So they all agreed that Cohn's military record would never be mentioned. And just as the hearings were about to begin, Welsh, the famous Boston lawyer who opposed McCarthy, learned that a young man on his staff had been a member of a fairly communist organization when he was a young person at the Harvard Law School. It was the National Lawyers Guild. So they agreed that nothing would be mentioned about the National Lawyers Guild. Now, McCarthy was reckless. McCarthy could have really made something much wilder than he ever dreamed of, but he was so reckless, he destroyed himself right on TV because he brought up the name of that young lawyer. And at that point, Welsh began those great speeches that began, "Sir, have you at long last no sense of decency?" At long last, no sense of decency. And the American people heard that, and they heard it unanimously, and the Senate heard it. And for the first time, the Senate, which had groveled and crawled before McCarthy, stood up and passed, even after the hearings were over, passed a motion of censure. It's what the Greeks called in their tragedy hubris, that overweening, irrational pride that brings you down, brings you to destruction. And this is precisely what brought. It wasn't the good guys who brought him down. McCarthy brought himself down.
I thought we should just call to your attention the fact that your Mr. Fisher, who is still in your law firm today, whom you asked to have down here looking over the secret and classified material, is a member of an organization not named by me, but named by various committees, named by the Attorney General, as I recall. He belonged to it long after it had been exposed as the legal arm of the Communist Party. Knowing that, Mr. Welch, I just felt that I had a duty to respond to your urgent request. that before sundown, when we know of anyone serving the communist cause, we let the agency know. We are now letting you know that your man did belong to this organization for either 3 or 4 years, belonged to it long after he was out of law school. Now, I have hesitated bringing that up, but I have been rather bored with your phony request to Mr. Cohen here that he personally get every communist out of government before sundown. Therefore, we will give you the information about the young man in your own organization. Now, I'm not asking you at this time to explain why you tried to foist him on this committee, that you did the committee know. Whether you knew that he was a member of that communist organization or not, I don't know. I assume you did not, Mr. Welch, because I get the impression that while you are quite an actor, you play for a laugh, I don't think you have any conception of the danger of the Communist Party. I don't think you yourself would ever knowingly aid the Communist cause.
Mr. Chairman, well, the chair to say that he has no recognition, no memory of Mr. Welch recommending either Mr. Fisher or anybody else as counsel for this committee.
I will put on the record, Mr. Chairman, the news story on that.
Under these circumstances, I must myself have something approaching a personal privilege. Senator McCarthy, I did not know, Senator, sometimes you say, may I have your attention?
I didn't know. May I have your attention?
Now, this time, sir, I want you to listen with both.
Good.
Senator McCarthy, I think until this moment...
Let me ask, Jim, when you get the news story, the effect this man belongs to this communist-run organization...
Will you get the citations?
What are the citations showing that this was the legal arm of the Communist Party and the length of time that he belonged, the fact that he was recommended to Mr. Welch? I think that should be in the record.
Senator, you won't need anything in the record when I finish telling you this. Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness. Fred Fisher is a young man who went to the Harvard Law School and came into my firm and is starting what looks to be a brilliant career with us. When I decided to work for this committee, I asked Jim St. Clair, who sits on my right, to be my first assistant. I said to Jim, pick somebody in the firm to work under you that you would like. He chose Fred Fisher, and they came down on an afternoon plane. That night, when we had taken a little stab at trying to see what the case is about, Fred Fisher and Jim St. Clair and I went to dinner together. I then said to these two young men, boys, I don't know anything about you except I've always liked you. But if there's anything funny in the life of either one of you that would hurt anybody in this case, you speak up quick. And Fred Fisher said, Mr. Welch, when I was in the law school, and for a period of months after, I belonged to the Lawyers Guild, as you have suggested, Senator. He went on to say, I am secretary of the Young Republicans League in Newton, with the son of Massachusetts governor. And I have the respect and admiration of my community, and I'm sure I have the respect and admiration of the 25 lawyers or so in Hale and Dole. And I said, Fred, I just don't think I'm going to ask you to work on the case. If I do, one of these days that will come out and go over national television, and it will just hurt like the dickens. Mr. So, Senator, I asked him to go back to Boston. Little did I dream you could be so reckless and so cruel as to do an injury to that lad. It is true he is still with Hehlendorf. It is true that he will continue to be with Hehlendorf. It is, I regret to say, equally true that I fear he shall always bear a scar needlessly inflicted by you. If it were in my power to forgive you for your reckless cruelty, I would do so. I like to think I'm a gentleman, but your forgiveness will have to come from someone other than me.
Chairman, may I say that Mr. Wells talks about this being cruel and reckless. He was just baiting. He has been baiting Mr. Cohen here for hours, requesting that Mr. Cohen, before sundown, get out of any department of the government anyone who is serving the communist cause. Now, I just give this man's record. And I want to say, Mr. Welch, that it has been labeled long before he became a member, as early as 1944.
Senator, may we not drop this? We know he belongs to the Lawyers Guild. And Mr. Cole nods his head at me. I did you, I think, no personal injury, Mr. Cole.
No, sir.
I meant to do you no personal injury. And if I did, I beg your pardon. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
And who do you think the hero or heroes of the McCarthy Army hearing? Do you think it was Welch, the senators, or perhaps television itself, really?
Doug, I wish you wouldn't give me the whole answer on this question, because there's no doubt in my mind that it was the camera and the sound. It was television that was the hero. Mm-hmm. I mean, Welch was a great lawyer and a highly sympathetic figure, but he too finally was a hired gun, as most great lawyers are. The more money you have in our society, and any other society, I suppose, the better chance you have of hiring a great lawyer, which means a lawyer with a great fee, and beating the case. But what really destroyed McCarthy was that camera that's looking at me now, and which looked at McCarthy over a very long period of time. When you multiply the number of hours and the number of days from April through June of the year 1954, it was 188 hours that the American people looked at him. And nobody can hide in 188 hours. In 188 hours, if you're a good guy, it's revealed, no matter how clever you are or how much you want to hide even being a good guy. And if you're a bad guy, it's also revealed. And McCarthy was revealed, and the machine stripped him, and he was destroyed.
So you then chose to make a film about the Kennedy assassination as your second film. What led you into this project?
Well, Mark Lane and I together became involved in the film on Kennedy. Kennedy was a classmate of mine at Harvard. I don't feel sentimental about my classmates, but I thought that Kennedy was an important president, and I think he had an agenda that had to be stopped. And this is why we made the film, because we did not believe the Warren Report, and we thought somebody other than Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Or at least that if Lee Harvey Oswald had a role, it was a minor role. To begin with, Lee Harvey Oswald was a poor shot. In the second place, we now have so many facts and so much proof about other people who were in Dallas that day who had a real commitment to the killing of Kennedy. And then there's the political aspect of John F. Kennedy himself. Kennedy had alienated a good many people, although he didn't do very much, but he spoke at and he spoke very convincingly about changing things in regard to civil rights. This alienated a certain portion of the population, but most importantly, he alienated the CIA because he did stop the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba. And it is my belief that he was getting ready to pull out of our tiny, at that point, tiny presence in Vietnam. He had already withdrawn 1,000 troops, and he didn't think the war was winnable. And so he wasn't essentially an idealist, but a pragmatist. And pragmatic people are generally wiser than ideologues, like the right-wing lunatics who wanted the war in Vietnam. And so he had to be killed, just as his brother had to be killed.
The most striking thing in looking at the film today is the amount of witnesses that you compiled interviews with who claimed that they saw gunshots or heard gunshots or gun smoke or movements in this grassy knoll on this fence, which was very close to the passage on the freeway where Kennedy drove past. Witness after witness confirmed that they think that that's where the gunshot came from. How were you able to get these people on film, and why didn't the Warren Commission go after them to the extent that you did?
What the Warren Report and Commission failed to do makes you feel not only that it was flawed, but that there must have been something else afoot, because we found witnesses, simple Texas working people, honest people who had no axe to grind, who were on top of the overpass. Kennedy was being driven down toward them. They saw what happened as well as anybody. There were five of them there. The Warren Commission interviewed S.M. Holland first. He was the foreman of these five people. And his testimony was so amazing, in which he said he believed that shots came from the grassy knoll, did not come from the book depository building, that there was more than one shooter, that there were not three shots but four shots. The Warren Commission did not want that testimony, so it took a little bit of the next man and none of the other three.
What was your position with the railroad company?
Track and signal supervisor for the Union Terminal Railroad. I've put in 41 years of railroad service in the signal department.
Did you look in any particular direction when you heard the shots?
Yes. I looked over to where I thought the shot came from, and I saw a puff of smoke still lingering underneath the trees in front of the wooden fence. The report sounded like it came from behind the wooden fence. And a policeman throwed his motorcycle down in the middle of the street and run up the embankment with his pistol drawn. He was running toward that particular spot. And also another motorcycle policeman right behind him tried to ride up the embankment on his motorcycle, and it turned over about halfway up the embankment. And he got out, got off his motorcycle, and left it laying there and run on over to the fence with his gun in his hand.
Where do you think the shots came from?
Well, I know where that third shot came from.
Where did that shot come from?
Behind the picket fence.
Is there any...
Close to the little plaza.
Is there any doubt in your mind that that shot came from behind the
fence? There's no doubt in my mind. There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind in the statement that I made in the sheriff's office immediately after the shooting, and the statement that I made to the Warren Commission. And I made it very plain there was no doubt in my mind what there was definitely a shot fired behind that picket fence.
Is this where you were sitting on November 22nd, Mr. Price?
Yes, sir.
Right here?
Right here on this spot.
And where did you think you heard the shots come from?
From behind the overpass over there, triple overpass. That's where I thought the shots were coming from.
And where did you see the man run?
Over behind that wooden fence, past the cars, and over behind the Texas Depository building.
Did you give that information to the Dallas Sheriff's Department on the very day of the assassination?
Yes, I did. I'd say in about 30 minutes after the assassination.
Were you ever called as a witness by the Warren Commission?
No, sir. No, sir.
I show you this map published by the Warren Commission of the Dealey Plaza area and ask you if you would mark on it where you thought the shots came from.
Yes, sir.
That's just behind the wooden fence where it joins the overpass. Is that correct?
That is correct.
We're now here more than 2 years after the assassination. Now, where do you think the shots came from on November 22nd?
Well, I can't be sure. It seems that from all information that's been gathered that the shots came from the Texas Boat Depository, but I can't hardly believe that. Although I never did look over there at the building, but really I think the shots came from that direction. Seems that everything pointed to that fact that they came from the Book Depository building, but I can't buy that right now. That's about it.
At the time the shots were fired, did you look at the Book Depository building?
No.
Did you think at that time that the shots came from the Book Depository building?
No, I thought it came from a fence between the Book Depository and the railroad track.
Does anyone else who you know or who you've spoken with also believe that the shots came from there?
Most everyone thought it came from the fence behind the Book Depository.
Did you have occasion to speak with Forrest Sorrells, who was, of course, a friend of yours, and the Secret Service agent in charge of Dallas that day?
Yes, I did.
Did he tell you where he thought the shots came from?
He thought they were coming from the same place.
Which is?
Behind the fence.
At the present time, where do you believe the shots came from?
Well, they came from the Book Depository because there's proof that it did come from there.
I see. This you've read in newspapers and you've read the report.
Yes. I believe the Warren report.
I would say that he was possibly 30 feet away when the first bullet struck, moved a little closer, and was possibly 20 to 25 feet away when the second bullet hit.
Did you see the effect of the bullets upon the president?
When the second bullet hit, there was the hair seemed to go flying. It was very definite then that he was struck in the head with the second bullet. And, yes, sir, I very definitely saw effects of the second bullet.
Did you see any particles of the president's skull fly when the bullet struck him in the head?
I saw a piece fly over. Oh, in the area of the curb where I was standing.
And in which direction did that fly?
It seemed to have come left and back.
In other words, the skull particle flew to the left and to the rear of the presidential limousine.
Sir, whatever it was that I saw did fall both in that direction and over into the curb there.
You were a ranger during the war, correct?
Yes, sir, I was a ranger during the war. Took part in the invasion of France and was shot a couple of times. So, as I say, it's possibly like swimming. I hadn't heard that sound for many a year, but you don't forget it once you've heard a shot rounding, coming close to you.
Did you speak with newsmen on November 22nd and tell them what you saw?
Yes, sir. And told them simply that their two shots had hit the president and the direction that I had thought the bullets had come from.
Did you at any time that day make a statement which was televised?
Yes, sir.
Fortunately, I was probably 15 to 20 feet away from the president when it happened.
Tell us exactly what you saw, sir.
He was coming down the street, and my 5-year-old boy and myself were by ourselves on the grass there on Commerce Street, and I asked Joe to wave to him, and Joe waved, and I waved, and the man...
That's all right, sir.
You were ahead, as he was waving back, he was... The shot rang out, and he slumped down in the seat, and his wife reached up toward him, and as he was slumping down, and the second shot went off, and just knocked him down from the seat. I'm positive it hit him. I hope it didn't, but I'm positive that it hit him, and he went all the way down in the car. Then they speeded up, and I didn't know what was going on, so I just grabbed the boy and fell on him in hopes that there wasn't a maniac around. I'm sorry. I can't help you more, but I won't forget it.
Did you make a statement to the Dallas Sheriff's Office?
Yes, I did.
How long did you remain in the Dallas Sheriff's Office that day?
I was, say, about 3 hours to 4 hours.
Were you among the closest witnesses to the limousine when the shot struck the president?
Yes, sir. I would have to say that, if not the closest, one of the closest to the unfortunate incident. I did get a view of something I'll never forget.
Were you called as a witness by the Warren Commission?
No, I was not called by the Warren Commission to testify.
In effect, Mr. Holland, the Warren Commission published just a very small portion of your testimony and used your testimony as proof that no shots could have come from behind the fence. Did they accurately and fairly use your testimony?
They are wrong, because my testimony, and I made it very clear, that there was a fourth shot fired, and one of those shots came from behind that picket fence. And there's no doubt in my mind, and never will be, because I was on the spot, I saw the smoke, heard the report, and saw the smoke from behind that fence. And I don't see how that they could doubt there was a fourth shot fired.
The vast majority of the witnesses who expressed an opinion as to the origin of the shots agreed with Mr. Holland that the shot did come from behind the fence. These witnesses, as this picture shows, were positioned throughout Dealey Plaza. The commission concluded that no credible evidence suggests that the shots were fired from any place other than the Texas School Book Depository building. Mr. Holland, you were on the overpass. You were probably in the best position of any witness on November 22nd. In your view, did the Warren Commission present all of the facts regarding the assassination of President Kennedy?
Well, let me say this. The Warren Commission, I think, had to report in their book what they wanted the world to believe when they read the Warren Commission. As you know, as well as I know, that everybody in the world was reading this Warren Commission, and it had to read like they wanted it to read. They had to prove that Oswald did it alone.
Page 71, Warren Commission Report. In contrast to the testimony of the witnesses who heard and observed shots fired from the depository, the commission's investigation has disclosed no credible evidence that any shots were fired from anywhere else. Page 61, Warren Commission Report. No credible evidence suggests that the shots were fired from the railroad bridge over the Triple Underpass, the nearby railroad yards, or any place other than the Texas School Book Depository building.
Nobody ever asked, who the hell was Ruby? Why was Ruby, who was a pimp, who ran a cheap nightclub, who was a drug dealer, Why did he feel that it was a patriotic duty to kill Oswald? And then when Earl Warren came with other members of the Warren Report and they talked to Ruby in his cell, Ruby said, "Mr. Chief Justice, take me out of this cell. Take me to Washington and I'll tell you the truth." This clearly implied he had not told the truth. And then Ruby died of cancer 6 months later. Now, doesn't it seem reasonable to think that somebody put Ruby up? I mean, this is an assumption that had to be examined. I'm not saying it's the truth, but it had to be examined and weighed carefully and considered. Isn't it at least reasonably possible that Jack Ruby was said by one of his bosses, "Look, you've got terminal cancer. Go in and kill this son of a bitch, and you'll be comfortable in jail, and you'll die, and you're going to die anyway." Mm-hmm. I mean, something like that. Maybe he said it more kindly than I've put it, but it could have been something like that. It was something the Warren Report, had it been efficient and honest, would have brought up, questioned, weighed, and then thrown out if they could prove it was not. They left too many strings lying around.
Were you employed by Jack Ruby?
Yes, I was. This was in 1961 in Dallas at his club, the Carousel, and I was bartender, waitress, and rather the manager there.
How did you get that job?
I had gone into Dallas not knowing anyone, and of course the first place I went was the police department, and they were very kind and got me the job there.
They got you the job at Jack Ruby's?
Yes, they did.
Did they know Ruby?
Personally, oh yes, very well. Vouched for him, wonderful person, great man. Well known by the Dallas Police Department.
What were your duties there?
Well, general bar duties, such as setting up the liquor, getting the bar ready for the evening trade, waiting tables if he was short-handed. Otherwise, I'd be behind the bar serving the drinks.
Did you ever serve drinks to Dallas police officers?
Oh, yes. In fact, the Dallas police officers were the special boys, shall we say. We even had a private stock for them.
Private stock?
Oh, yes. They wouldn't... bar liquor wasn't for them. We had names such as Hague and Hague or Black Label. The very, very high-priced drinks on the house, of course, you'd never... And that was a gross oversight if you ever charged a Dallas police officer or any official of the city of Dallas or Tarrant County.
Well, other than the Dallas police officers, what officials did frequent Ruby's establishment?
Oh, such as your district attorney, which would be Mr. Wade.
Did you receive any specific instructions from Jack Ruby about serving drinks for the Dallas police officers?
Yes. In fact, Jack told me point blank. He said, "Nancy, if you ever," he said, "intentionally or unintentionally charge a Dallas police officer," he said, "you might as well go look for another job." He said, "don't offend them, cater to them, talk with them, even if you ignore the other customers. Bend over backwards to be nice to them."
Did Ruby perform any other favors for the Dallas police officers?
Well, yeah, well, favors, we call them favors, I suppose so. He provided girls, gambling, and booze.
How many Dallas police officers would you estimate Jack Ruby knew on a personal basis?
At least half and probably two-thirds.
There were almost 1,200 police officers in Dallas in 1963. Would you say Ruby knew 600 of them?
Oh, easily.
A great deal has been written about the relationship of the Dallas Police Department with Jack Ruby. We have 1,200 men in our department, and we had each man to submit a report regarding his knowledge, our acquaintance with Jack Ruby. Less than 50 men even knew Jack Ruby.
Did you see police officers drop into the Vegas club during the 6 years you worked there?
Oh, very definitely. They would come in there all the time, off duty, on duty, and so forth. And
how were they treated?
They were treated royally.
You testified before the Warren Commission, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Did they ask you how many police officers Jack Ruby knew?
No, they didn't ask me that question.
I've just read your testimony, and as I recall, they ask you one question about a police officer. They ask you if you knew a policeman named Harry Olson. Mm-hmm. You said you didn't remember the name.
That name didn't register with me.
But that was the only question they asked you about policemen.
About policemen, yes. They asked me numerous questions, but nothing about police other than that one that you just named.
Now, the other thing, can you believe this? Could anybody in his right mind believe this? That all the material they took in the interviews with Oswald, Chief Fritz, Chief Investigative Officer of the Dallas Police, Chief Curry, the chief in charge of the whole police department, they had no notes, no record of any notes. Now, here you're interrogating, if he's guilty, the most important criminal in modern times, the most important criminal since the assassination of Lincoln, at any rate. And they don't keep any notes? I mean, you know, that isn't feasible. I mean, it makes the whole... See, any place where you touch the Warren Report or what the police did, wherever you touch it with a probing finger, you knock it out. I mean, could anybody believe, ask any honest cop, ask any military policeman, ask anybody who's ever run a courts martial or a judge who's run a trial, that if police have interrogated a guy for 8 hours and who has killed the President of the United States,
right,
there'd be no notes? Those two people should have been fired. Instead, they stayed on the force until they retired.
The main point of your film, Rush to Judgment, was to raise questions concerning the Warren Commission's theory that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. You punctured many different holes in this theory, but you didn't really offer an alternative hypothesis. At this point in time, many years later, do you have some ideas about who you think might have been involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Well, this is probably better informed than the Warren Report was, but I never pursued it. I never did a lot of work on it because I went on to make other films. I mean, right. I covered what I had to cover in the film Rush to Judgment. But right. I'm convinced that it was a combination of Cubans and CIA people. Cubans under the direction of CIA people. Cuban veterans of the Bay of Pigs.
The Cuban exiles, not Cuban citizens.
Not Cubans living in Cuba today or then, but the same exiles who attempted to overthrow Castro in the Bay of Pigs operation, which Kennedy halted, you know. Those people believe to this day that if he had put up the B-26s and bombed the beaches, and if he had used more naval cover, that they would have won. And it was at the last minute that he called off the B-26 strikes. And those people hated John F. Kennedy with a passion, and they hate him to this day, even though he's dead. And it's absolutely my belief that they, with the CIA officers who ran them together, were responsible for the death of Kennedy.
Do you think the mob had any role? Jack Ruby obviously had mob connections. He seemed to be part of a conspiracy plot.
Well, I hope you don't think this is a light joke, but it's my feeling you have enough people at the ball without the mafia. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's possible that the mafia was involved, and it's possible that the mafia may even supplied weapons or something, but you have too many people there. And most of the evidence that points, there's a woman that Lane found long after we made the film who had been the mistress of Castro and then became an anti-Castro person and was involved with the Cuban community. And she talks of making a trip to Dallas with a Cuban guy who was involved with the CIA, even in Watergate. And Lane says before the court, and he won this case, by the way, Lane did, what was in the car besides you people? And she said, the trunk was full of high-powered rifles.
That was Marita Lorenz, right?
Yes, exactly. And that's, you know, why didn't the... I mean, if Lane could find that person, yeah. Why... I mean, you know, if a civil lawyer can find that person, where was the FBI? Where were the investigators in the Warren Commission?
Lane also alleged that E. Howard Hunt, who later turned up in Watergate and who had involvement with CIA and these right-wing Cubans, was also present in Dallas that day.
That's absolutely true. So was Richard Nixon present in Dallas that day, but nobody thinks he had anything to do with the death of Kennedy. That's something quite different. But Howard Hunt was there,
right.
And Howard Hunt had lied about that,
right.
And he lied in court about it. And And this all took, this case ended only 3 years ago.
Well, didn't Marita Lorenz say that the caravan carrying rifles that she was in was met in Dallas by Hunt, and he was the one who received them and then paid them off?
She did say that. But that was in Spotlight.
Right.
And Spotlight is not a paper, is not the New York Times. I mean, I try to be as conservative as possible, which is why I didn't bring that up. You brought it up, which I'm glad you did, because I frankly believe it. But, you know, it doesn't have the same evidentiary weight that the New York Times has, or the fact that Hunt lost a case in which he lied about where he was.
Comes Oswald down the hall again.
You buy that rifle.
Just as fast as you people have been given, but I emphatically deny these charges.
Oswald has hustled through a doorway.
And he told anybody he planned to kill the president.
He hasn't admitted killing the president to anyone.
You have any reason to believe that there's any organization behind him?
How is it he says there's nothing mentioned to it?
Well, I don't know what he said. He says he didn't do it. We're still working on the evidence. This has been a joint effort by the Secret Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Dallas Police Department, the Dallas Sheriff's Office, my office, and Captain Will Fritz has been in charge of it.
How would you describe his mood during the questioning?
Very arrogant. Mm-hmm. Has been all along.
What do you say, Chief?
He just denies everything. Mm-hmm.
How do you sum him up? As a man, based on your experience with criminal types?
Oh, I think it's a man that planned this murder weeks or months ago and has laid his plans carefully and carried them out and has planned at that time what he's going to tell the police that are questioning him at present.
What was his motive?
He didn't give any motive since he denies them both.
It's one of the great mysteries. And the Warren Commission has been, that belongs to the garbage can of history, and so does the Warren Report. And what will go on is, you know, more and more people die, so there's less and less evidence, but people will go on asking that question as long as people ask questions.
I would love to see a computer faced with the problem of coming up with the probabilities of the assassination taking place the way it did, with all of these strange incidents that took place before and are continuing to take place after the assassination. I think all of us who love this country should be alerted that something is wrong in the land.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our crew for helping with the program: Brian Lynch, Sue Kim, Roger Nussenblatt, Maria Lopez, Catherine Galatera, and Rosalind Peacock. And we are most appreciative of Lisa Ann Henderson, who gathered all the material and edited it up on this four-part series on Emile D'Antonio. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Goodbye.